Joe Nick Potofsky is the author of An Epic Life, Willie Nelson. Good morning, Joe Nick.
Good morning, Trevor. How are you doing?
Well. How did Patsy Cline get hold of that wonderful song?
You know, that's where Willie's friend Hank Cochran, the songwriter who had a bunch of hits on his own, he was a song plugger for Pamper Music, Ray Price's publishing company, and he was at a song swap with Willie at Tootsie's Orchid Lounge, and he kept asking Willie, who wrote that one? And Willie said, I did. Well, long story short, he signed up Willie to a songwriter's contract, $50 a week. And one of the first things he did was take one of these songs that Willie had come up with over to a recording artist that Hank knew very well, Patsy Cline. And Willie stayed outside in the car. He wouldn't come in while Hank was talking up his song. But finally, you know, Patsy said, well, why didn't he come in and sing it for us? And Willie did. And Patsy Cline did not want to do that song. She thought it made her sound too vulnerable and too weak, not like a strong woman as she had been projecting herself with other songs like Walking After Midnight. And there were differences of opinion, but Owen Bradley prevailed in the studio. He told Patsy, you do one of yours, I'll do one of mine. I want to do this one. And it really is the song that made Willie Nelson as a songwriter. He had already had some success with songs like Family Bible, and soon he would have Funny How Time Slips Away, was covered by many people, and Farron Young had a big hit with Hello Walls. But Crazy is the song that made all the difference in the world, because it was not just a country hit. That's one of the biggest jukebox hits of all time.
How did it then make his career stronger and bigger as an artist itself, and not just as a songwriter?
Well, you know, that's interesting that Willie gets to Nashville in 1960. And this is a lot happens within 1 year where he gets discovered as a songwriter. His songs are beginning to get covered by other people. He's making money. But he's also, at the same time, playing in the band of Ray Price. He's a Cherokee cowboy. He's out on the road. And what people begin to discover, both Ray Price and Farron Young took him aside and said, why don't you just stay at home here? Don't go on the road with the Cherokee Cowboys and just write songs for me. It's a good, easy living. And they didn't understand until Willie told them. He said, I don't want to just, you know, other people to sing my songs. I want to be you. I want to be Farron Young. I want to be Ray Price. Willie wanted to be a performer. And really, the following 10 years of his period when he's a Nashville recording artist is a story of his success as a songwriter, but his frustration of getting over as a recording artist, as a performer. He had to leave Nashville before that really happened.
Let's go back a little way, because I was fascinated to read that Willie was a bit of an athlete at school. When you take a look and think of Willie Nelson, you never think of him as being sporty or as an athlete.
Well, you have to consider, put it into context, that Willie went to school in Abbott, Texas, a town of 300, a cotton farming community just north of Waco. And, you know, it was a school small enough that everybody participated.
I get it.
And I talked to some of the fellow students at school, and they always said whenever we had anything to do with talent, Bobby and Willie, Willie's sister Bobby and Willie, well, they would always be the talent. That's what people knew. So that's one thing. But when you're in high school, there's not many boys in that in his class. And so basically everyone was recruited to play football, American football.
Yep.
And Willie famously played for the Abbott Panthers. He was a running back, and he did okay, but that really never got him off the mark. I mean, it was something he did for fun. It wasn't like he thought he was going to be a football player when he grew up. At that time in his life, even in high school, he was very determined to become a performer.
Who were the people that were his influences when he was young?
Well, Willie had a lot of influence, and I think the greatest influences were his grandparents who raised him and came down from Arkansas with his mom and dad. And his grandparents were singing school teachers. So they'd go into a little communities in Arkansas, in rural Arkansas, and basically teach the whole community how to sing using what's called shape note singing. You didn't have to be literate to read these hand signals, which would teach you how to sing. And they would get paid with hogs and chickens and livestock and maybe even a little bit of money. So when they came down to Texas, Willie had two of the greatest role models in his grandparents, who are both music people. His grandmother in the evening used to sit down and write songs. I mean, that was part of what they did. But beyond that, the greater world did not go unnoticed by Willie. And I think probably his biggest influence early on, and there's many. I mean, you can say Leon Payne and Floyd Tillman for his vocal stylings. But talking to him, it was pretty clear that Bob Wills, the leader of the Texas Playboys, the biggest Western swing band in Texas and by virtue of that in the world, Bob Wills was really an inspiration. And he actually promoted a show while he was still in high school with his sister and brother-in-law. And his band opened up for Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. And Willie recounted that how the band would start playing and they just keep going. There wasn't much pause between songs, only except maybe every three or four songs they'd slow down and play a slower song. But the staging, the intensity, and Bob's control, command of the stage were definitely huge influences on Willie. And they speak to why he's not a country or country western songwriter or performer only. He's as much a western swing player out of that Bob Wills mold as anyone.
It was interesting, as also as you take a look at his life, he didn't get it on a platter. It's not as if he was able to move straight into the music industry. He had to do a lot of jobs, and whether it be trimming trees or doing all sorts of things, he did whatever was needed to be able to make money to be able to continue with his music.
It was, look, the Nelson family, the grandparents that raised Willie and Bobby, they were poor, and his mom drifted off 6 months after Willie was born. She hit the road, the first one to go on the road, Willie liked to say. And his dad was in and out. He was a mechanic, and he was kind of a wannabe musician. And Willie actually joined him in the honky-tonks nearby. But, you know, they were so poor, people said. The Nelsons were poorer than most of the other people in this very poor cotton community. They were so poor that Willie's first horse was Reddy the Cow. They couldn't even afford a horse. And so the hustle was always there. And this is such a great classic American story in that Willie and his whole family did what so many other people did to get by. If you didn't own land and have your own farm, you pick cotton. And it was the time that Willie was picking cotton as a kid, and he heard Mexicans singing in Spanish. He heard blacks singing field hollers. He got a lot of influences. But when his neighbor, John Raycheck, a Czech guy who actually came from the town of West, which was south of Abbott, when John Raycheck invited Willie to join John's family polka band, and they liked Willie, young Willie. He was an impressive kid. He made impressive impressions on people. So he played guitar in a Czech band that played polkas, and it was all brass. You couldn't hear that guitar, come on. I mean, with all the tubas and saxophones and trumpets. But they paid Willie at the end of the gig, and he realized he made more money for sitting in with John Raycheck's band than he would have made in a full day of picking cotton. And that's pretty much at that point in his life, he decided what he's going to do when he grows up. He's going to be a musician. He's going to follow music. So his hustles all along the way, trimming trees, he was a salesman, a door-to-door salesman. And he sold vacuum cleaners and encyclopedias. And it really informed who he is as a performer. And when even today, when he walks out on stage, people are cheering for him as he walks out, and he's basically, one of the first things he does is make eye contact with probably about 30 or 40 people in the front of the audience. He'll make eye contact with them. And so before he even opens his mouth to sing, there's 30 or 40 people in there saying, he's talking to me. He's looking at me. And I think that's part of one of these salesman skills, that he could sell anything. And he told me at one point when you know, he's having IRS tax troubles, well, if nothing else, I'll just go, I'll take the phone book and go up one block and sing songs and go up down the other block and sing songs. He was always very resilient in that respect. But I remember when I took the book to him, and in the middle of it, Willie had just been dealing with some people that had a new product called Water, this contraption that took humidity and make water out of it. And he was endorsing it. And he did a little demo about this Water after I delivered the book. And I saw that salesman that was selling encyclopedias, that was selling Bibles, that was selling vacuum cleaners, and that was selling him and his music for the past 50 years. And it blew my mind because he's such a good salesman. You know, when he gets into that routine and he's really on fire, it doesn't matter what he's selling. You just want to, you want to buy it.
Hello, Chris.
Hey, good morning, Trevor. Good morning to your guest. Look, I'm a young 63, and I saw Willie Nelson with my new wife 43 years ago in Sydney at a live concert. First concert I'd ever been to. And my wife hates country music to this day, but anyway, we had the best night out. We were four seats from the stage, or four rows from the stage. And the thing that fascinated me was I saw a band, an Australian band came out and supported him, was Bulla Makenka, which I'd never heard of or seen before, and they were fantastic. And then this fellow came out, looked so much like Will, it wasn't funny, and he strummed a guitar and played this little ditty tune saying, Willie, my best mate's going to come out soon. He said, I'm just here to check the sound. And, you know, it was just so lyrical. And then after that, he walked off, the lights went dim, and then boom. And Willie came out and played for about an hour and three quarters, I think it was. But it was reported that there was Hell's Angels were there to protect him. But the back of the stage, it was all of these motorcycle fellas there. Whether they were just there to protect him or just have a good time, I don't know. But it was just a wonderful, wonderful night I've ever had in my life.
That's one of the things about him, Chris, thank you, is that he has such a diverse listening audience, Joe.
When he started blowing up in the early 70s, and that was in Austin and in Texas, that he was a thing in Austin, Texas, from about 1973 till Redheaded Stranger in 1975. Then he became a national and international phenomenon. And early on, it was a thing to behold, to watch him. One is to watch him play. First time I saw him was on in 73 at a car lot, an automobile dealership that was showing off the new 1974 Fords. And they were playing, his band was playing on a flatbed trailer in the room where the body shop was. They did all their body repairs. And it was such a classic, oh, this is a country show. In fact, it was live band, free hot dogs, free soda. And, you know, showing off the new cars. Well, I knew who Willie was, and I went to go see him. And that was a classic country context. But while they're playing, and it was I'm pretty sure it was Take Me Back to Tulsa they were playing, the old Bob Wills standard, they started taking off on a jam. And I'd just seen the year before the original Allman Brothers, you know, which one of the great jam bands of all time. I'd seen the Grateful Dead. But I did not expect Willie Nelson to go toe-to-toe with either of those bands in his ability to jam. And it basically blew my mind seeing him then. And the great thing, talking about the Hell's Angels, Chris, backstage, all of a sudden, you go to a Willie Nelson show in Austin, and, you know, it's not like there's 20 people that he knows. There were 200 people backstage, and it was all walks of life, from Hell's Angels to politicians, sheriffs, law enforcement officers, drug dealers. I mean, it was, you saw the breadth of what Texas really is. And I've never seen that before. And they're all together and they're all having a good time because it's Willie.
We'll skip around a little bit. Obviously, we're not going to be able to cover everything about Willie's career. But tell us the significance of him meeting Waylon Jennings.
Well, Willie and Waylon, as we know, are basically the two figureheads of the outlaw movement that shook up Nashville, changed country music. But Willie had actually met Waylon. Waylon was from the Texas Panhandle up in Littlefield, and Willie was from Central Texas, Abbott. But he met Waylon, had heard about him, knew about his music, but he stumbled upon Waylon when Waylon was basically holding court in the late 60s at a place in Phoenix called JD's, and it was a really, you know, spacious, super spacious club. But Waylon was drawing, you know, every weekend that he's playing there, over 1,000 people a night, and was pulling in crazy money. So Willie, you know, meets Waylon. Willie's already he's a Liberty recording artist. He's fairly successful as a songwriter. And he stops in, and he and Waylon just kind of hit it right off. And Waylon told Willie, yeah, I'm fixing to make my shot at Nashville pretty soon. And Willie told Waylon, he said, would you give me a heads up before you do? Because I want your gig here in Phoenix. I mean, it paid so good. But as it is, Waylon made the trip up to Nashville. Willie didn't go back to JD's. But as Waylon becomes, you know, he becomes a big act in country music, much bigger than Willie is as far as a performer. And so big that Waylon goes outside the regular rule book, I guess, and he hires a New York manager, a real bulldog named Neil Reschen, who Neil's claim to fame is, who else is he managing? No one in country music. He's managing Miles Davis, the jazz trumpeter. And Waylon hires Neil. Neil basically hammers out the first contract of any Nashville artist that gives the artist control. And Waylon, luckily, fortunately, tells Willie, you ought to try my manager here, Neil Reschen. And that's basically, Neil did the same for Willie, and that's why Willie had artistic control and why Columbia had to put out Redheaded Stranger in 1975, even though he made it for less than $4,000. And the people at Columbia Records thought, this is a nice demo, but you really need to, you know, sweeten it up and all that. And so Willie said, no, this is your album. And the only reason Columbia put it out is because Willie had artistic control. So Waylon was invaluable in helping Willie on the business end. And really, then the roles kind of changed by the time Redheaded Stranger comes out. I mean, both of them are the first acts to country acts to play stadiums. And in fact, that when they're playing stadiums in California, the Hells Angels are doing security for them. There's that kind of, it's a weird deal, but
yeah.
But those two kind of rose up. But I always got the sense, I mean, learning the story again, Willie's success kind of rankled Waylon a little bit, because Waylon stayed in Nashville and he was the Nashville outlaw, and Willie was kind of impish and he liked teasing Waylon and getting him all fussed up. And yeah, you know, Willie is just this figure. When you're around him, you can see it. He is the guy that water, you know, comes off of him like a duck's back. That nothing bugs him, nothing phases him, and he really is kind of off in a world of his own. And I think that kind of corn fuzzled Waylon at some point. And certainly, you know, as even though they stayed together all the way through the Highwaymen. It was as much a rivalry as it was, you know, a true brotherhood.
George, good morning.
G'day, Trevor. What's your guest name? Sorry, I didn't quite catch it.
I'm Joe Nick.
Hey, Joe. How are you? Yeah,
I'm pretty good.
Well, firstly, I think I attended the same concert in Sydney that previous gentleman referred to many, many years ago now. And the band he was trying to think of, the support band, was a great Australian bush band I'm sure that Trevor is familiar with, Joe might not be, the Bushwhackers. And what was incredibly ironic, they actually got kicked off the tour a little bit later after a few dates. And the apparent reason, supposedly, and this is incredibly ironic for a Willie Nelson tour, they had a song called Marijuana. And apparently it was considered too controversial for a Willie Nelson tour. So that's the alleged reason. So one thinks possibly that maybe Willie's management either thought they were, you know, too good, you know, some support bands are taking the light off Willie, or possibly they thought a song about marijuana might bring the attention of the police onto the tour and they might raid Willie's dressing room, which they probably wouldn't want to do.
I'm kind of going with the latter theory right there, and it sounds pretty pretty upright because they're traveling outside the United States, and all of a sudden weed's not as easy to find. And if they found any, they're sure not going to risk things that they didn't want to be blatant about it during that period of time. I mean, today, I don't know anyone who, I mean, he's the poster child for marijuana. And I got to say this, that if you're going to sit down and smoke weed with someone, ain't nobody, ain't like anyone, when you're sitting across the table smoking weed with Willie.
He didn't have early success, Joe, with his records. What was the difference that swung that around?
You know, the lack of success early on from really from the recordings from 1960 all the way into 1972 was he was trying everything. And, you know, it was just that he didn't fit in this system. And Nashville is a system. It's an assembly line. You take raw talent and you go polish it and you go do these things and you come out with hit records. And everybody tried hard. I mean, at RCA, and Chet Atkins wanted to have success for Willie, and he never could have it. But I think looking back on it, is this guy just square peg and a round hole? He did not fit in this system, and it took him getting out of the system to finally find his sweet spot. But that said, you know, for all the talk about the Nashville sound and the Nashville system and it cramped his style, I mean, for the last 20 years, Willie has reverted to that, you know, working with Buddy Cannon, the Nashville producer, and working with Buddy's people. It's back to that kind of thing where you come up with songs, you go in the studio, everybody records, and a record comes out of it. It's not necessarily your band. It's not necessarily, you know, all your songs or other songs. But Willie, that's that old Nashville system, which I got to say personally, I just was part of a Texas Monthly project where we ranked all 143 Willie albums. And a lot of that Nashville stuff I really like. I mean, the album Yesterday's Wine, which went under everybody's radar, is cosmic if you sit and listen. And that was a Nashville production. So I've kind of become, made my peace with the Nashville system and the Nashville sound. It didn't work for Willie the first time around. But this most recently go-round, it's kept him going.
When you say he had to leave the system to actually find his place, what do you mean by that?
Well, his house burned down in Nashville Christmas 1970. And one of his promoter friends down here in Texas said he knew of a dude ranch near Bandera that was bankrupt and was empty. So he could go. He took all his band and he would Willie already had basically a glorified commune going up in Ridgetop outside of Nashville where the mailbox said Willie Nelson and many others. And he took most of those many others after that fire with him to Bandera, where the band played golf. In fact, and they discovered they took LSD and they played golf backwards under the influence of LSD. But they also played a regular gig every Saturday night at Floor's General Store in Helotes outside of San Antonio. And if you go to Floor's today, you'll still see the sign Willie Nelson every Saturday night. And so the band kind of got their, you know, they expanded their mind while they're hanging out in Texas. They went back and did some recording in Nashville. In fact, finished Yesterday's Wine and The Words Don't Fit the Picture. But it was coming to Austin to visit his sister Bobby, who played in a piano bar in Austin, that opened their eyes. And it's like they picked up a hitchhiker, a young woman, a female who was hitchhiking to Austin, and they were on their way to Austin, and she had them please let me out at this place, and it was the Armadillo World Headquarters. And that raised their eyebrows. So Willie and his drummer and his back and manager, Paul English, showed up at the Armadillo in the beer garden and told Eddie Wilson, the head honcho there, we want to play your place. And Eddie said, I've been waiting for you guys. And that show at the Armadillo is the infamous one where it wasn't a full house, and it was half hippies and it was half classic country people with beehive hairdos and leisure suits. And they all showed up and they all celebrated Willie Nelson. He only played with a three-piece that night, but they danced country and they all drank beer because that's what Texans do in the middle of summer. And, you know, a lot of those country people, they discovered they like pot too. So there was like the hippies and the rednecks laid down together. under the influence of Willie Nelson's music. And that basically, you want to know about Austin, Texas, or why Austin is the city that it is globally now, it goes back to Willie Nelson in Austin, Texas, back there in 1972-73.
Steve, good morning.
Good morning, Trevor. And Joe, I had supper with Willie at the Siebel Townhouse when they were out here for the Highwayman concert. And Willie was just like me and you talking together. He wasn't your superstar, known all over the world, played the full houses everywhere. He was just another country singer. And my band and I went up to the Siebel Townhouse because we were friends with the maitre d' there, and he got us the tickets to see the concert. And Willie was just another guy, and I couldn't believe it because I thought he'd be very standoffish and everything.
Joe, is that typical of what he was like with his fans, with people that supported him?
Yes, I mean, until he got carpal tunnel syndrome back around 2004, Willie was the guy that if he's playing a show, he stays at the end of the show until every autograph is signed, until everyone that's been waiting for him has that moment. And I got to say, look, I did over a 500-page biography, and I'm not trying to be crass, but as a writer, I sucked the marrow out of his bones. I mean, I really tried to look at him every which way. And when you do that, often you find a personality, you know, the person behind that personality is not that personality. You find them to be unpleasant, or, you know, they're just overly ambitious or narcissistic or whatever. Willie is the person you think he is. And that's, look, there's a lot of talented people out there. There's a lot of musical people out there. But they don't have that, and Willie has that, and it's a skill. It's not a skill. It's just it's him, and it's being at ease with who he is. And every politician in the world, every business leader wishes they had that skill. But I'm here to tell you, as far as I've looked at this, there's only one Willie Nelson, and there are no substitutes.
You mentioned also earlier about with Waylon Jennings, and they went off in their own separate ways, but they then came together to do things together again. How significant was that when they actually worked together with music?
Well, the song Good Hearted Woman really tells the tale on that, and that's Willie and Waylon in a Fort Worth motel about 2 or 3 in the morning playing poker. And Willie's ex-wife, Connie, was there and happened to be a witness and came up with the line "Good-hearted woman." So that's, you know, those are running, their fellow running buddies. But I think both of them got to the point where they were almost, they were so big in their own right that, you know, sometimes having to share that stage or, you know, go on tour together, you know, there might be a little bit of teeth gnashing. But the formation of the Highwaymen, which basically revived not just the career of Waylon Jennings, but of Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson, whose careers had been lagging. Willie's career had not lagged yet at that point as much as the others, so he kind of like was holding them up. But that Highwayman was a great example of just the power in of collaboration and that Willie and Waylon brand. And you know, of course, the first platinum-selling country music album ever, Wanted the Outlaws, was Waylon and Willie. And, you know, they had a couple other pairings that were extremely successful that were over the top. But what people don't always understand with Wanted the Outlaws is that was RCA Records just trying to duct tape together a bunch of existing tracks. And it wasn't new material, although Willie did go back in and re-record some stuff for RCA. And he had no reason to do that other than, oh, you want to put an album with Waylon? Oh, sure. Yeah, I'll accommodate you. Never mind what the details of the contract are.
When you take a look at that, though, Willie Nelson, Waylon Jennings, Kris Kristofferson, and Johnny Cash, they were sort of the rebels of the country music scene as well.
Definitely, because in looking at the progression of country music, in the 60s, Johnny Cash upended what conventional country music was in Nashville. He had a national television show. He hosted Bob Dylan when Dylan did Nashville Skyline. He made alliances and stuck his neck out where he probably shouldn't have. And Cash was followed immediately in the late 60s, early 70s by Kris Kristofferson, who started out sweeping the floor in Cash's studio and worked his way up. And I remember, like, 73 in Austin, Kris Kristofferson was the biggest thing in country music. And when he starts showing up at Coke FM in Austin and just showing up all around town at El Rancho, Rita and Chris are hanging out with Connie and Willie, that's a big deal. And in fact, Willie takes this is a progressive country radio station, a commercial station in Austin. Just on a whim, Willie takes Chris up to the station. Hey, let's do a concert. And they go on the air and start playing. And, you know, Kris Kristofferson is the biggest thing in country music at this time. So Chris kind of bleeding over into Waylon and Willie, that's kind of like, you know, Waylon was a continuum of that outlaw thing in Nashville. And Willie basically planted his flag in Austin. And whether you want to call it the new Bakersfield or whatever, Austin became the anti-Nashville. It's whatever Nashville was, Austin wasn't, and took pride in that. And it's because you had this contrarian who always did things differently but did it his way. This contrarian becomes the figurehead of this very diverse movement that, you know, how do you lump together Doug Somm, folky like Michael Murphy, a guy with a great voice like B.W. Stevenson, a wild man like Jerry Jeff Walker. You know, those are pretty disparate musicians, but Willie becomes this figurehead because everybody is tied to Willie and everybody loves Willie.
Did Nashville start to recognize and respect them as they progress in their careers and want them back, or did they want to then embrace them?
I think Nashville certainly did, which, you know, when Jerry Bradley put together One of the Outlaws in 1976, that to me was very indicative of that. But what was it, 2 years ago? I think the exhibit still may be up, although with the virus, I'm not sure. But a couple years ago, Nash at the Country Music Hall of Fame, an exhibit opened called Outlaws and Armadillos. And it was official country musicdom basically acknowledging Willie and what happened in Austin by pairing it up with Waylon and what happened in Nashville. And, you know, the exhibit was nice, but it was very Nashville-centric. And I'm still one of those that, coming from Austin, Nashville doesn't always pass the smell test with me. And, you know, it's too mainstream. And it's like, what are they going to do? How are they going to steal your soul? And Austin became that place in the 70s. It's like, okay, if you're not going to try to make it big, if you're not that driven to be a star, you just want to work out your ideas and play music, Austin's a much better place because ambition was not a big deal. That wasn't very important. Willie was ambitious, and he kind of punched through. But there were hundreds of other acts and thousands since in Austin who are still kind of – it's the art seems to drive the music more than the commerce.
Did they enjoy it? Did they like playing together? Were they good together? Or was it like just big people
all together? Well, it depends who was behind them.
Yeah.
And I got a great story from Mickey Raphael, the harmonica player for Willie. And he said that, and he knew this because B. Spears, Willie's longtime bass player, had actually left Willie for a while, played with Waylon, and then he came back with Willie, and Willie wasn't firing anybody, so he had already had Chris Etheridge from the Flying Burrito Brothers who was playing bass. So there was a point when Willie had two drummers and two bassists. I mean, it was a freight train of a band. But Waylon's band, according to Mickey, and actually according to Floyd Domino, the piano player who's played with both artists, he said that Waylon's band used to put down Willie's band because they couldn't play. I remember when Floyd was talking about this, we laughed because, yeah, well, it was B. And he told this story that B. Spears was probably the only one, although Kevin Smith does a great job, that really can hear Willie. It's kind of like playing bass with Lightnin' Hopkins. Willie has a different sense of timing and meter and, you know, runs ahead of the beat and behind the beat. Never sings on the beat. He's a jazz singer. And there was a time when Willie and Waylon's band were touring, and I don't know how it happened, but all of a sudden, Willie steps onto stage with Waylon, and it's Waylon's band. It's not Willie's band, and they can't play behind Willie. They get lost. And, you know, it's because, you know, B wasn't there. And I was told the same thing happened with the Grateful Dead when they were touring with the Dead. Sometimes, you know, the musicians would switch off, but it's like when the Dead was playing and Willie was singing, they couldn't play with him because he's so far, you know, he's in his own world, and B was honed into his frequency, as is Kevin Smith now, the new boy, who's only been aboard, what, 10 years, something like that.
What does he put down his longevity to?
You'd have to ask him, but my guess would be there's been a lot of credit given to weed, only because Willie's ex-wife, Connie, Willie's eldest daughter, Lana, all the people around him said that Willie was, and Paul English, his drummer, would say Willie was just a horrible drunk. Paul said, you know, he'd start drinking, he'd always want to drive, and I'd have to take the keys from him. And when he moved to Austin, not that he'd already been experimenting up in Nashville, but somehow in Austin, he settled on, you know, smoking marijuana rather than drinking. He still drinks occasionally, but it's not like his obsession is his main thing. And even, you know, today, this very moment, I'm not sure how much he's doing weed. I know that smoking's become an issue with he has breathing issues today. So I think he's doing edibles. But he said as much that marijuana probably saved his life, that he would have been, and he quit smoking tobacco at that time. So, you know, those two things could have taken him down. But longevity, I think he's doing exactly what he was put on this earth to do, and he knows it. He's doing what his grandparents taught him to do. And he's doing it with his sister, who they've been doing it together for 83 years, something like that. And, you know, when you're doing what you think you're supposed to do and you're having fun, I'm convinced to this day, no matter what he's doing, if wherever Willie is at this very moment, if there's people around him, there's nothing he'd rather be doing than playing guitar for him and entertaining them.
When you take
he
a
loves
look,
doing that.
Because he does a lot of duets now, and with a lot of younger artists as well. So he's almost likes to be involved with younger artists as well. I know he plays with his son Lucas sometimes as well.
Yes, Lucas has been out of all his kids, and he has many talented kids. His daughter Paula performs. His daughter Amy is part of Folk Uke, but Lucas and Micah, who are from his children with his wife Annie, who is his longest. He's been married to Annie longer than any woman. Those kids are really kind of his pride and joy. Lucas is kind of an heir apparent. He's got some charisma, and he's really learning. He's come along so far musically. He's fun to watch, and Micah is kind of the artistic. He's the out there explorer, the experimentalist. They're fun to watch, you know, it's not just his kids, but it's like I remember Margo Price. He was really champion a few years ago. He's always picking people that are, you know, on their way up. And are going to be somebody. And he's done a wonderful job. I mean, Jamie Johnson, he was championing him. Toby Keith, when Toby Keith was nobody. So that's Willie. And the thing is, given who he is, it's not like he has to go out and look for them. They come to him.
Joe, thank you very much for giving us a taste of Willie Nelson. I know I've seen his son Lucas play, and he does a good impersonation of Willie as well. Thank you very much for joining us on the program.
My pleasure, Trevor. Anytime.
Joe Nikfateski, who is the broadcaster, writer, and author of Willie Nelson, An Epic Life, and An Epic Life It Is.